Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello, and welcome to another foreign stream edition of The Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined remotely yet again by my Guinness-chugging co-host, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Tell me, Charlie, are Irish eyes a-smiling upon you, lad?
Well, you know how on a St. Paddy's Day, we're all Irish together, even if you're not Irish. And I am not Irish, even though I know this sounds like the most authentic Irish accent you've ever done heard. But we watched a film which pretty much sounds like our amazing Irish accents. And Guinness plays a role in this film that we're going to talk about, Wild Mountain Time. And it's so effective that I went out and I bought a 6-pack of Guinness, and I am enjoying the fine beverage at this very moment.
Oh, I'm very glad. I don't have any here, but I did indeed watch the movie. And I think we're going to have a little bit of a disagreement as to how the accents may have hurt or really not made an impact on people's viewing of this film. Where do you stand, Charlie?
Well, I was noticing it while watching it, and it's getting mocked online. It's going to become a thing. It's getting memed. There's even an Irish guy in it. Your boy Jamie Dornan is Irish. He's not really getting made fun of, but you know who is a little bit is Brit, Emily Blunt, and Queens, New York City, Christopher Walken are getting hammered for their attempts at Irish accents. But that's just chaff. That's not the film. That's just bygones. It happens. It's not the worst. The worst thing I've ever seen is Anne Hathaway and her British accent. I think that was called One Day, if you remember that.
One Day, yeah, where she falls off her bike or something, or gets hit by a car.
Yeah, what annoys me is John Patrick Shanley's version of Ireland. He's Irish-American, as in he grew up in America and his ancestors are from Ireland. This is adapted from his Broadway play. They said, hey, so make a fine movie. Let's give you some borderline A-listers. Let's go make a film. And it's kind of a romantic dramedy. And if it wasn't written, if the dialogue wasn't this lyrical prose kind of sweet talk, it would have annoyed me more, because you have boy and girl, star-crossed lovers. But how can they be? They grow. It's like they were born on the same day, just on separate pastures. They live in the farmhouses next door from each other, and you know they're meant to be. Emily Blunt knows it as Rosemary Muldoon. She knows she is destined to marry Jamie Dornan. What is his name?
Is it Anthony?
Anthony Riley. She knows she's going to marry Anthony Riley. The problem is Anthony Riley doesn't seem very interested. She's throwing herself at him. And I think they don't say how old they are in the film, but I think they're closer to 40 than 30. And his dad, you know, all their parents are dying. They kind of take it, you know, every half hour another parent dies. And Christopher Walken, as Anthony's father, he knows his time is coming. And it's time for him to pass down the farm. And he's not going to give it to Anthony, the only child that stayed. He's actually thinking about selling it to an American played by John Hamm, who thinks it would just be fun to own an Irish farm, and maybe once he gets eyes on Rosemary, you know, tackle her for himself. So this is a, I don't know, 102-minute will-they-or-won't-they kind of romantic comedy, but there's not a lot of comedy. And what I'm leading up to is the biggest twist of 2020. You don't know why. Why will Anthony Riley not give Rosemary the time of day? And when you do find out, it's going to split the audience down the middle. Half of people will be like, oh, it's okay. It's fine. I don't care how they did it. And the other half will be like me. Have you lost your mind? This is the dumbest, laziest excuse for writing I have seen all year. Way to torpedo your film, John Patrick Shanley.
I didn't think it torpedoed it. I just thought it was weird. It's just a weird little twist. And, But the whole thing, the whole film is quirky. And you talk about John Hamm being in it. So John Hamm is related. So it's not like he's just saying, oh, I'm going to give the farm to some American. I think Hamm's character is a cousin. So it's
but
the American
cousin.
He's
never worked a day in his life on a farm.
No, he's not a farmer. No. So, but yeah, so the reasoning behind that is a little hard to really buy into. But, and there's not, I mean, John Hamm, this is not a huge role for him. This is a pretty small part. I actually expected, based on the cast list, for him to be in it a little more. But he's got his reasons for being there. And, you know, there's a little bit of a love triangle possibility going on with Rosemary. So, you know, I just found it to be a rather charming little movie. It's not one of those ones that you're going to, you know, remember in 6 months. It's not going to be on your awards list. But it's got the appeal of Jamie Dornan and Emily Blunt. And they are two very versatile actors. And to see these two players who were, I mean, this is as far as you can possibly get from Christian Grey and Mary Poppins, okay? And the theme song, Wild Mountain Time, I actually was not, I think I'd heard it at some point. It's very catchy. You kind of find yourself sort of humming along to it. And by the end of the film, it's used in a fairly moving sort of way. And so Wild Mountain Time is just one of those just kind of quirky, decent in the moment romantic dramas with two very watchable top-notch actors.
Hannah, I agree that this has charm. I actually really like watching these two together. And the writer, John Patrick Shanley, he's good. We all know him, even though you don't recognize his name. He wrote Moonstruck, which means he wrote that delicious role for Cher and that amazing role for Nicolas Cage when he's yelling at her in the street, "Now go upstairs and get in my bed." That's this guy, the same writer. He wrote Doubt, you know, with Viola Davis and Meryl Streep. Did the priest do it or didn't he do it? He wrote Joe Versus the Volcano. Talk about a cult classic. I love that
definitely.
Movie.
So, did you really?
I do. I love Joe Versus the Volcano. I have a brain cloud. It's a wonderful
film. Was that Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan?
She's a flibbertigibbet, if you remember. But what I don't like is, and a lot of Irish don't like, and more than the accents, which is, you know, that's just something you can pick on because it's so overt, is its depiction of Ireland. This is movie Ireland. This isn't real. Ireland is a modern nation state. But in this film, it's still that 19th century. All of Ireland is one little tiny village hamlet. And they all go down to the pub at night and sing traditional folk songs together. And everybody knows what everybody's doing. Because old Mr. Cleary is hanging over the rock wall fence. And so it really gets on, you know, Irish natives' nerves. Like, you know, you're not even from Ireland, sir, and you're stereotyping us again. This is why everyone kind of makes fun of Ireland a little bit, and that we're backwards, because they're doing it again. So I could see, you know, I don't take personal umbrage from it. I'm not from Ireland. I have nothing to do with Ireland, but I could see why they would get continuously annoyed with it. And, you know, I love to see them. I love me some Christopher Walken. But, and this kind of makes up for the war with Grandpa that he was in a couple months ago with Robert De Niro. I just don't know if he belongs in this film.
Yeah, no, that's a valid point, but I didn't worry so much. I like the scenery, the landscape, and to me, it was just, you don't really think about what time you're in, like what year this is supposed to be. To me, it was just this rural Ireland, the farmlands, and it was about passing down these farms from generation to generation, and they live a bit off the grid compared to the rest of, you know, the more metropolitan types. So I really didn't have a problem with that. I enjoyed just kind of being plopped into this little Irish fairy tale, and that's kind of what it was just sort of a quirky fairy tale that just happened to be set in Ireland.
I'm going to keep my eye out, though, for the reactions. When people watch this and then post about how they feel about the ending, I'm looking for some hot takes.
Yeah, it'll be fun when it's been out long enough that people can actually talk about it openly, because we really can't say anything.
We can't, but let me tell you, folks, it's a doozy. It's a doozy.
There will be buzz.
Were you saving that, or did that just happen? That's phenomenal.
Moving on.
We split in the middle. I watched a few things this week. Hannah watched a few things this week. So we're going to start with one I saw. And you can go see right now. It's on Netflix, and it's called Mank. Now, everyone knows of Citizen Kane because it's habitually ranked as the number one American film ever made, Citizen Kane. And it's boy wonder Orson Welles. He's like 24 or 25 when he made this film confronting William Randolph Hearst and taking on this system. So it's really got this, a lot of baggage coming with it. Mank is not about Orson Welles. It's about Herman Mankiewicz, the guy who wrote the screenplay. And that's when you say, wait a minute, Orson Welles directed it, starred in it, edited it, produced it, and he won an Oscar for co-writing it. Well, this film says, yeah, he was a co-writer, but he didn't write it. That was back in the day when anyone in the studio could get themselves a writing credit before the Writers Guild. Herman Mankiewicz wrote this script, or at least according to David Fincher. You know David Fincher, Seven, Fight Club, The Social Network, and about eight other amazing things. David Fincher is crafty. When he makes a movie, you know he's making a movie. And his idea was, what if we make this movie like it was concurrently made with Citizen Kane? It's in black and white. The camera angles are low. The focus is deep. He even recorded the final mix in a theater to give it an even more old theater sound feel. That's how much this guy's diving in to Mank. Now, Mank is played by Gary Oldman. He's getting some award buzz. You know, he's all in. He's playing an alcoholic writer, you know, the best kind of writer, who's just chipping away at the story. Herman Mankiewicz knows William Randolph Hearst. He knows Louis B. Mayer. He knows Irving Thalberg. They're all here. This takes place in the 30s, so there's a lot of what Los Angeles was like in the 30s. A lot of the Depression, a lot of politics, the Republican governor who's running against Upton Sinclair, who everyone's calling a socialist. Sound familiar? Amanda Seyfried shows up as Marion Davies, who's Hearst's paramour. She and Herman Mankiewicz know each other very well, apparently. So I really liked it because I'm a sucker for, you know, period, well-made period dramas. Black and white, contemporary 2020 film, hook it up. David Fincher, sign me up, plop me down. 2 hours, don't care. Mank did not blow me away, though. It's chippy. It's okay. I wasn't bored, but man, I wasn't blown away. This is the kind of film that's just, it just feels Oscar-y, doesn't it? It just feels Oscar-y, like it would get all those acting awards, a picture nod, a producing whatever, but it's leaving people a little bit cold. Mank has got it's got really low viewer counts on Netflix. It's going to fade away quicker than a normal Fincher film would. So Hannah, any interest in you in hopping on Netflix this weekend and checking out Mank?
Probably not. Artie Chick did review it for Chick Flicks, and I think she kind of fell pretty much in line with what you're saying, that you know, she liked it, and that it's going to be, but it's for the cinephile. You know, there really is. For the people who are going to appreciate the vintage look and will be familiar with all these characters from the time. So it's one that, if there is enough awards buzz, if anyone's nominated for something, then I'd go back and watch it. But because of all the other things coming down the pike, it would not float to the top of my list unless it became a contender.
I think Gary Oldman and Amanda Seyfried are almost safe bets. No one's a safe bet right now. But I think if I had money on it, I would definitely include those two. But, you know, we don't have box office this year, but clout and viewership numbers, even though they shouldn't count towards performances, always do. If your movie tanks, that hurts your chances of getting nominated in certain awards. Not necessarily the regional guilds like we're in, but the major Hollywood voting ones, box office and buzz affects that. You know, Hollywood loves to make movies about Hollywood, so this also gives that a check mark in that box. But oh man, I just wish Mank had a little bit more of a gut punch than it really has. But since you can go find out for yourself. It's on Netflix right now. Everybody has Netflix. Go watch it. You saw another one, which is all you can also see right now if you have Amazon Prime Video. So what did you check out this week, Hannah?
I saw a quiet and engrossing sort of crime drama called I'm Your Woman. And it stars Rachel Brosnahan, who most people would know from The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And she is not playing Mrs. Maisel here at all. It's a very different role for her. And I think you hardly recognize her. And then you're like, wow, she pulls it off. And she plays this woman who's forced to go on the run after her thief of a husband wrongs the wrong people. And so it's set in the 1970s suburbia. Brosnahan plays this woman, Jean. She's living this life of leisure. She's supported by her husband, Eddie's ill-gotten gains. And you never really quite know their backstory, but they don't have any kids. But one day he shows up with a baby in his arms and he's like, hey, we've got a kid now. And she really asks no questions. She just takes the kid. He's a baby boy. She goes about her daily routine and takes care of the kid. And so that's sort of her existence until all of a sudden one day somebody shows up in the house and tells her that Eddie did something really bad and he's out on the run and she's in danger and the kid's in danger and they've got to just get out of Dodge. And Eddie's old friend Cal is going to take care of them. And so this guy Cal, played by, I think he's a British actor, Arinze Kenne, I'm not really sure how you pronounce his name, but he is really, really good. So initially, you kind of get this relationship between this character Cal and Jean, and Cal puts her in a safe house and tells her very specifically, don't interact with anyone, don't trust anyone. And of course she does, and he has to take her to safe house number two. And safe house number two is this remote cabin where Cal's wife, Terry, their son, her father-in-law, they're all holed up in this one-room safe house. And then it sort of shifts a bit, and Cal goes missing, and Jean and Cal's wife, Terry, kind of go on this journey into the criminal underworld to try and find out what's happened to Cal and to Eddie. And it turns into really it's a female empowerment story. And it's about sort of betrayal and motherhood and friendship and taking control of your own life. And it's really designed. It was directed and co-written by a woman, Julia Hart. And her aim was to sort of give a female perspective to the gritty 1970s male-centric crime dramas. And I think it does that. I really enjoyed watching it. It was very, very engrossing. And I think you would have liked it. And so, you know, I don't know if Rachel Brosnahan maybe has a shot at some kind of awards talk, but it's one of those just really solid dramas that, is a decent watch if you've got Amazon Prime, but whether or not it really breaks through into the mainstream remains to be seen.
It does sound like I would like it. In fact, I'll probably end up watching it this weekend. The scary part is when you say 1970s, mob, women empowerment, I immediately thought of last year's The Kitchen.
Do you remember that?
With terrible movie, The Kitchen, with Melissa McCarthy and Tiffany Haddish and Elizabeth Moss, who was totally awesome, by the way, in such a garbage film. But I know these are...
This
is getting a lot better buzz than that stupid movie.
Oh my God. No, it doesn't even, they don't even compare. This one actually veers more towards the strength of Widows. So that film, it reminded me more of Widows than of The Kitchen. I had thankfully forgotten all about The Kitchen. Thank you very much.
Hey.
This one, I'm Your Woman, is definitely, I would say, significantly better than The Kitchen. And depending on the type of movie you like to watch, it goes down easier than Widows.
A lot of people like Widows. That was a movie that had such good word of mouth, and especially for its ensemble cast, that nobody went to the theaters to see. So it just fizzled out.
That one was much more violent. It was a harder watch. This one is... just for the performances, just those key performances by Brosnahan, by Arinze Kenne, and and by this woman, Marcia Stephanie Blake. It's those three that really, really that hold your interest throughout the film.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, I do want to check it out. It sounds really good. I saw Wander Darkly. Talking about female directors, Wander Darkly has one of those. Tara Mealey. This is about a couple. They're not married. They're boyfriend, girlfriend, but, you know, they're steady enough that they just bought a house together and they have a newborn baby. And they are fighting. You're not long for this world as a couple. They're just not cutting it. And driving home one night, they get in a horrific car accident. Adrian, the girlfriend, played by Sienna Miller, is in the passenger seat, and the driver is Diego Luna. Diego Luna as Mateo. This is a caught between life and death, purgatory, where am I, what's going on with me? It's not necessarily a mystery or a thriller, but it's one of those devices that gives the character a chance to examine their lives before, I don't know, they wake up in the hospital or they die and they cross over to the other side. Apparently Mateo is fine, but Adrian she's in the hospital and she's actually up and walking around, kind of like Patrick Swayze. You know, remember in Ghost when he can see his dead body? That's her. She's looking at her dead body on a gurney, getting wheeled into the morgue, and she's freaking out. She's starts jumping and shifting through time. So she goes to her funeral. She goes 16 years into the future. She jumps back. We're all over the place here. I think it's because her head is just so, I'm freaking out right now. I'm dead. What am I going to do? And she starts, you know, looking at the major plot points of her life with Mateo. We see how they meet. We see how they fall in love. We see how they begin to fight. We see, you know, we just see the major high points you would imagine you and yourself with your significant other. And Mateo, you know, she finally gets to him. She's like, Mateo, I know you think I'm in this room with you right now, but I'm not. I'm dead in the morgue. And, you know, she starts to bring him around, convince him a little bit. But it's not, don't think this is Ghost and she has to prove something that I'm really am dead and I can move things around. It's not like that at all. This is a relationship study. It's not romantic, but it's a challenge. It's not linear. It's first a story about the baby, but then it's a story about how they met. It's just so chaotic. And it's even too chaotic for me. And I love jumpy, shifty stuff like this, but it needs to calm down. This film is way too high strung on a high wire. So not the biggest thumbs up for me on Wander Darkly. In fact, I'm not particularly recommending this film, even though Sienna Miller is very, very good with some weighty emotional scenes. Go wander somewhere else instead of Wander Darkly.
It sounds a little too darkly to wander to for me, so I'll probably skip it.
I'm totally going to tell you the end after we're done recording, too.
Oh, good, good. It's like reading the last page of a book. I'm fine with you just kind of spoiling it for me.
It's twisty. It's very twisty.
Is it I See Dead People?
Who knows? No, it's not as good as that. Speaking of, well, not as good, but it's still good. Let's talk about this year's Parasite, and I'm paraphrasing. Everyone's going to think it's this year's Parasite because we have another Korean film invading cinemas that's coming in with just as much buzz as Parasite has. And you know what happened to Parasite. That did pretty darn well for itself. Now we have Minari. It is not Bong Joon-ho. It is Lee Isaac Chung. And it's autobiographical. He waited to make this film until he said he had like three or four other films under his belt. And I looked him up and like, I've never heard of any of those movies. But this is autobiographical of the time in the 1980s when his father, in this movie played by Steven Yeun, moves the family from California to Arkansas, buys a farm with an attached mobile home on it, and tries to pick up farming. It's very family-oriented. You got dad, you got mom, you got daughter, you got son. We get to know son a lot, and we get to know grandma, who comes to live with the family, and we get my favorite, Will Patton, who's the farmhand, who I think deserves his own prequel. I liked Minari. I liked Minari a lot. I didn't love it, though, Hannah. Did you love Minari?
No, in fact, I think that's what I said when I think it's just one of those films that a whole lot of people, it's a crowd pleaser. A lot of people would just come out and just be like, wow, I really like that. Like, that to me was the kind of film that it was. It was family friendly. And I think it's going to still potentially do very well because it's got such a good ensemble cast going for it. And I found parallels to me. It was like, oh, it's like Little House on the Prairie, only it's taking place in the 1980s instead of the 1880s. And it's, you know, Arkansas instead of Minnesota. And it's a Korean American family as opposed to, you know, these Midwesterners. But I felt the struggle was similar. You know, it's about these parents who were seeking better opportunities for themselves and their kids, and about the search for community and the cruelties of nature. And I it's very tender. It's got some heartbreaking moments, some lighthearted moments, and Grandma is just awesome. I loved Grandma in this film.
Yo Jung Yoon, I love Grandma too. And a little 8-year-old getting a lot of buzz, a little Alan Kim is David, who's very precocious in this film. But only one parent is on board with this idea of moving to Arkansas and starting up the farm. Mom, on the other hand, makes it known she does not want to live in this mobile home. I thought you were going to garden, not farm. And I didn't know this was a profession. They are chicken sexers. They pick up the newly hatched baby chicks, check the undercarriage. And if you're a boy chick, sorry, dude. I did not know that was a thing. Apparently that's a thing. And you're supposed to go through as many, you know, a certain chicks per minute, I think. You mentioned to me the other day that this has a very strong ensemble cast. Yeah, I suppose it does. But no, I'm really leaning toward Grandma here. And Will Patton, personally, I thought he was great, a great supporting actor in his limited time on screen. And this has just got, you know, best foreign film, best international film nomination written all over it. But
yeah, I couldn't tell whether it's supposed to be an American film or a foreign film, because I think it's actually an American film.
Yeah.
So I don't know what categories.
Right. Would Korea submit this for international film? I don't know if they would
I don't think so.
But
yeah, I think it's a foreign film and an American film and an arty film and a mainstream film all wrapped into one in English and Korean with subtitles. So I think it's got something for everyone.
It is. I mean, it's in Korean and it's in English. But and you know, Lee Isaac Chung, he's American. He's straight up, you know, he's David in this film. He's got an American accent. He speaks better than you and me. You know, he's an American. The wife's not though. She's straight up Korean. This won the Best Film Award at the Middleburg Film Festival, you know, the one we didn't get to go to this year. And usually, that's not always a harbinger, because last year the Two Popes won that. not always.
Yeah, but
they were raving about this film. They were raving about it. Like, oh, this is it. This is the next Parasite. This is the next Best Picture. I'll knock it out in November. But it's not. It's actually not the year's Best Picture.
I don't know. I mean, it won the Dramatic Grand Jury Prize and the U.S. Dramatic Audience Award at Sundance as well. And so I do think that that gives it some extra traction. And I do think that while it doesn't rise to the level of Parasite in terms of the layers that you can really peel away in Parasite.
Not Parasite's biggest fan, by the way.
No, exactly. It's still, I like this one more. You know, to me, that this is to me just a more audience-friendly film and easier to watch as a family. I mean, so this is a PG-13 film, not an R-rated film. And so I think it's got a, more people can watch it. And I just think the kid is so freaking cute who plays David. So it'll be interesting to see where he goes next, Alan Kim. It's just got these great themes, and you just like it. And that's right now when there's just so much other not good stuff out there, just in not even just talking movies. But I think this is just the kind of movie where you're okay with just being able to emerge from watching something and just be like, oh, wow. That was really good. And so it gets points, extra bonus points for me for that very reason.
Well, I think it's my favorite film out of the four I've talked about on this episode. But I'm not going to join the chorus of people that are lining up to sing its praises. I didn't love it. It was, you know, I've seen family drama before and people pick up and try to start new lives. And this fits firmly in that mold. It doesn't break the mold. it's in the mold. Yeah. You know, so it's just not really my cup of tea.
I like the mold.
But it's good. I mean, you care for this family, you care for the characters, and I'm rooting for them. I want them to win. I want them to succeed. So if a film is able to make you do that, then it's winning. It's doing its job.
Yeah, and I do think that it's the strongest overall of the films that we've been talking about this week.
Oh, certainly.
But there are some really, really big ones on tap. And no pun intended with your Guinness drinking over there. But, you know, we'll have Tom Hanks in the Western drama News of the World, which we have seen but can't talk about just yet.
Well, we can, but we're not going to.
Yeah, we'll wait. George Clooney's sci-fi drama The Midnight Sky, which you've seen and I will watch this coming week. And that comes out on Netflix in 2 weeks. And I do think it's just worth reminding everyone that The Prom is now available on Netflix. So even though we talked about it last week when it was released theatrically, when nobody would really go see it, now I think a lot of people are going to watch it on Netflix.
Yeah, go get your Meryl Streep fill. She's got the lungs for some lung busting songs in this one. She's funny.
It's fun. It's a fun one. So I would say that would be the other top choice for the week.
No,
but then you know if you want to get your Ireland on, then you know a little Wild Mountain Time. Thyme.
I urge people, even more than Minari, I want you to go see Wild Mountain Time because I want your gut immediate reaction after you learn the ending, after they tell you what it is, and you're like, what is it? I don't understand. I want you to text me and call me and tweet me and Facebook me about how you are interacting with the ending of this film.
And I think that's a really good note to end on because people can find us online at thecinemaclash.com or tweet us at thecinemaclash. If you do see it, let us know what you think of the ending, and then we'll be able to review everyone's responses next time. Until then, thanks for listening. Stay safe, watch your distance, wear a mask.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.